Among the various methods of meditation, the popular one is what is known as the contemplation and the resolution of the effect into the cause. This is a very popular method prescribed in many of the scriptures. It is easy to understand too, and stands to reason. A suggestion that this method can be adopted in meditation is made in the following section of this Upanishad. The method is a contemplation on the process which is the retracing of the steps that are taken in the process of evolution. How things come from causes and shape themselves into effects. We have to understand the theory of evolution, creation, manifestation. How the one becomes the many gradually by stages. The same stages have to be completed, contemplated backwards. The grossest appearance of this manifestation is this earth plane. And we have individuals inhabiting this earth. They all come from certain substances emanating from the earth. They can thus be resolved into the earth. The body, for instance, which is constituted of the essence of food, is resolvable into the earth element, because the substance of food is the substance of the earth. Thus, anything that is in the body physically is subject to return to its cause, namely the earth, as it actually happens when the body is cast off at the time of death. The physical constituents return to their original abode, which is the earth. The earth has come from water, water from fire, fire from air, air from ether. And ether is itself an effect. It is not an ultimate cause. It is a first manifestation of Hiranyagarbha, Virat, and Ishvara. So they are the causes of even this space. The gods, the 14 worlds, the different realms of existence, all stages of being are manifestations of Virat. And all this manifestation, which is tripartite, Ishvara, Hiranyagarbha, Virat, is also resolvable into the Supreme Brahman. So that alone is. Hence, even these effects are nothing but the cause appearing in some form. So the perception of the effect is not in any way a bar to the contemplation of its relation to the cause, which is the true essence or the existence even in the formation of the effect. So, this is one of the methods of weaning the senses from objects of perception by resolving the very tendency of the senses to move towards objects. Because the objects are converted into the characteristic of their causes. And the causes thereof, namely the causes of the objects, are also the causes of the body, the individuality, the senses themselves. Whatever is the cause of our own personality is the cause of the world outside. So when one thing is resolved into that cause, the other thing also goes. So when we contemplate the resolution of the effects into that particular cause, the senses for the time being get cooled down, calmed down. And it becomes possible for the mind then to pay attention to the nature of that cause alone, of which both the objective side and the subjective side are manifestations. Some such thing is stated in this section of the Upanishad.
Apa eva idam agra asuhu, ta apaha satyam atrijanta, satyam brahma prajapatim, prajapatir devaha, te devaha, satyam evo pasate tadetat yaksharam satyam iti, sa ityekam aksharam, titekam aksharam, yamityekam aksharam, prathamottame aksharam satyam madhyamo, madhyato anratam tadetat anratam ubhayataha, satyena parigrihitam, satyabhuyam eva bhavati, Nainam vidvamsam anratam hinasti.
In the beginning, what was there? There was an undifferentiated, unmanifested, indistinguishable something. Asididam tamobhutam aprajnatam alakshanam apratarkyam avijnayam prasuptam iva sarvata. It was as if there was a cosmic sleep. It looked as if it is darkness. It is of the characteristic of darkness because there was no light of sensuous perception. There was no one to see anything. That which was to see and that which was to be seen, both were resolved into that which is now designated here as an apparent darkness. How can you designate it except as an absence of light, because we always define light as the instrument of perception, and perception does not exist there. There were no objects, because there was not world, there was not this manifestation. It was like a cosmic ocean. It is like waters spread out everywhere. Not these waters which we drink, but it is a symbolic term applied to designate the undifferentiated condition of matter, the potential state of being. Mula Prakriti in its essentiality, where the Trigunas, Sattva, Rajas, Tamas are in a harmonized state. There is Guna Samya Avastha. There is a harmonization of the Trigunas, so that you do not know what is there. Everything is there, and yet nothing appears to be there. Such a condition of homogeneity of potential being is usually called in philosophical symbology as cosmic waters. They are called Naraha in Sanskrit. And one who is sporting cosmically in those universal waters is called Narayana. So Ishvara himself is called Narayana. Apo Narayati Prauktaha, Apo Vai Narasunabha. Ta Yadasyayanam Dasma Atena Narayana Smradaha. Narayana is that being who sleeps as it were in the cosmic waters of the potentiality of being. Such was the state of affairs originally. Apa eva idam agra asu. Apa eva sasar jagre tasu vire mabasrije. So in all these cosmic and cosmogenical descriptions of the scriptures in different religions, we are told there was a universal state of liquidity, as it were, a symbolic way of putting into language the condition of homogeneity of the ultimate cause of the universe. Ta apasatyam atrajata atrajanta satyam brahma prajapatim. That condition becomes the precedent to the manifestation of something which we call the creator of the universe. The creator of the universe, or the divine will which projects this whole universe, is a blend of this universal potentiality and the great absolute. That particular state where the absolute appears as a will to create or manifest is, for all practical purposes, the original creative condition. That is called Satyam. Because there the true state of affairs can be seen. The original condition of all those things that are to be manifested are to be found there in their originality, in their archetypal being. It is something like the ideas present in the mind of a painter. The painting has not been projected yet on the canvas. But what is to appear on the canvas or a cloth outside is first present in the mind. That ideation which is to project itself externally in the shape of visible objects, that is Ishvara. That is truth for all practical purposes. That is Brahman itself. It is called Saguna Brahman or Vyakrata Brahman. It is the manifested form of Brahman. Satyam Brahma. That creates Prajapati, Hiranyagarbha, the subtle form of things, where an outline is visible of the future universe to be manifested. In the beginning it is only in a form of thought, it is only an idea in the cosmic mind. Now it is appearing outside as a bare outline, like the drawings through a pencil which the painter sketches on the canvas before the actual painting is completed. The idea of the painter is visible now in the form of outlines in pencil. They have been projected into a grosser form, yet they have not taken a complete form. That Hiranyagarbha becomes Virat, the projected universe. The whole painted picture of the universe in its completed form is what you call Virat. From that being, all the gods come. Devaha Satyam Eva Upasate. What are these gods doing? They are contemplating their own origin. The first manifestations in individual form are the celestials. The celestials are supposed to contemplate a universal sacrifice. This universal sacrifice contemplated in the minds of the gods is the subject of the Purusha Sukta of the Veda, for instance. It was a universal sacrifice, a sacrifice performed without any kind of material content. But all the materials available for the sacrifice or necessary for the sacrifice were present in the minds of the gods. Yajnena yajnama yajanta devaha, says the Sukta. The gods performed the sacrifice through the material culled from the body of the Purusha himself, who is the supreme sacrifice. So the devas perform this upasana in the form of meditation on their own cause, the Virat, by tuning themselves to its being. They contemplate the Satya or the truth which has manifested itself as Ishvara, Hiranyagarbha and Virat. Devaha Satyameva Upasate. Truth is the object of meditation. Now here in this Upanishad we have got a very strange suggestion given for contemplation on truth. Just as we were asked to meditate on the literal connotation of the letters of the word Hridaya or heart, apart from the meditation on the essence of the heart, which is a higher form of meditation, here we are asked to meditate on the letters of the word satya, truth, not the implication of the meaning of the word satya, which is a different subject altogether, but on the grammatical implication of the letters of the word itself. Satya is a word in Sanskrit, which means truth. How is this word formed? The Upanishad has its own etymological description of this word. Tadeta triaksharam. This word satya is constituted of three letters, three syllables into which it can be resolved. Sa iti ekam aksharam. The first letter is sa. The second letter is ti. Ti iti ekam aksharam. Then third letter is ya. Yam iti ekam aksharam. Sa, ti, ya. These are the three letters which form the word satya. Now symbolic is the interpretation of the meaning of these three syllables. The Upanishad tells us, just as truth envelops everything and there is that particular character of truth which is encompassing everything. It is present everywhere in every part of this world. And what you call untruth is a meager, frail existence in the middle of this all-consuming, all-enveloping being which is truth. Or to put it in more plain language, the phenomenon that we call this creation, which we sometimes call the unreal, all the relative, is enveloped by the real or the noumenon. The noumenon is real, the phenomenon is the unreal. But the phenomenon is enveloped by the noumenon. Reality encompasses the whole existence. It is present everywhere, it covers untruth from all sides as if to swallow it and to give it only the character of an appearance. Even what you call appearance or phenomenon has an element of reality in it. So the Upanishad is right in saying that truth is present even in untruth. The absolute is present even in the relative. The noumenon is present even in the phenomenon. Reality is in the appearance. If reality were not to be in the appearance, there cannot be even that appearance at all, because appearance also must appear. If the reality element were not to be present in appearance, appearance will not appear. There will be no such thing as appearance also. So the relative reality that we attribute or conceive to what we call appearance is due to the presence of a degree of reality in it. So reality is present everywhere. It covers unreality from both sides, from every side. Likewise, is the import of the syllables of this word satya. Sa is reality. Ya is reality. The middle one is unreality. It is a purely etymological derivation. And so we must be able to enter into the mind of the teacher of this Upanishad to understand why he conceives the meaning of the word satya in this manner. The commentators tell us that the middle syllable ti is called phenomenal, a form of death or unreality, because this letter T occurs in such words as mrityu, for instance, and anitya, and so on and so forth. Wherever words which denote unreality or phenomenality are used. Mostly it appears in Sanskrit language, the word ta comes or ti comes. So the Upanishad apparently suggests that those who cannot conceive the magnificence of truth as it is in itself may do well to contemplate at least the etymological significance of the word, just as those who cannot understand what the heart is and cannot meditate on the essence or the meaning of the heart may at least do well to contemplate the etymological meaning of the word hridaya as it was suggested earlier. Prathamottame akshare satyam. The first and the last letter of the word satya may be contemplated as the periphery of this universal manifestation of truth, the circumference as it were, the aspect of reality which covers unreality from both sides, inside as well as outside. Satya or truth is inside as well as outside. It is only in the middle that it does not appear to be. But even this appearance is made possible only on account of the preponderance of an element of satya only, says the Upanishad. Prathamottame akshare satyam madhyataha anradam. Only in the middle there is an apparent unreality. Tadetat anratam ubhayataha satyena parigrihitam. From both sides, untruth is caught by truth as it were, overwhelmed by truth and flooded by truth. So even where you see impermanence, there is permanence hiddenly present. Even where you see transiency, there is eternity manifested. Even in temporality, there is the presence of absolute being. Because even the conception, the sensation, the perception, etc. of what is not real is made possible only because of the presence of the real. So on either side there is truth, and in the middle only there is a phenomenal experience which is regarded by us as untruth. Satya bhuyam eva bhavati. After all, truth is supreme. The whole of creation is inundated with truth. So even in the worst of things and even in the least degree of reality, even in the lowest category of existence which we dub as untruth wholly, even there truth is present. After all, the Upanishad tells us in conclusion that it is abounding in truth. Satya bhuyam eva bhavati. You can't have a spot in space or a nook and or corner in creation or even an atomic element in creation where this truth is not present. Nainam vidvamsam anratam hinasti. If you can know this fact that truth is supreme, and the ultimate cause is present even in the least of its effects, that the supreme absolute is present entirely even in the lowest degree of its manifestation, even in the grossest of its forms and the most external type of objects. If one can be in a position to contemplate the presence of truth in this manner, untruth cannot harass that person. There cannot be trouble to that person from untruth, which means to say the world cannot cause any pain to that person, any sorrow to that person, any kind of grief to that person who is able to see or visualize the presence of truth, even in those things which otherwise are usually called untruth or unreality. This is a meditation on the abundance of truth in all creation, the presence of God in all things, the practice of the presence of God, as we usually call it. This is one of the symbols, one of the methods prescribed for meditation. Very abstract it is to conceive. It requires a little bit of stretch of imagination to conceive the presence of reality even in the appearances which are philosophically called sometimes unrealities. Thus you may meditate and you will find that by deep contemplation and meditation in this manner, you will be able to visualize the presence of God in creation, truth in objects, and the principle of moksha or liberation even in this world of samsara or bondage.
Tad yat tat satyam asau sa adityaha ye esha etasmin mandale purushaha yaschayam dakshine akshani purushaha tavetau anyonyasmin pratishthitau rashmibhirishaha astin pratishthitaha praniraya mamushmin sa yada utkravishyan bhavati shuddhameva etan mandalam pashyati nainamete rashmaya pratyayanti.
So we have completed the description of one type of meditation. Now we are told another kind. How do you meditate? I suggest another method for you, if it is practicable and you find it helpful. How do you see an object with the help of sunlight? There is thus a connection between sun and the eye. The light outside and the eye within are connected in a mutually correlative manner. That truth which is in the sun is present also as truth in the eye that perceives. There is a coordinating element between the sun and the eye. The deity of the eye, which is the sun, presiding over the eye, has an internal as well as an external connection with the eye. The purusha in the sun is also the purusha in the eye. The truth in the sun is also the truth in the eye. Sa aditya eha eshat etasmin mandale purusha yaschayam dakshine akshan purusha anyonyasmin pradishthita. The sun connects himself with the eye through the rays that he projects. The rays emanate from the sun and impinge on the retina of the eyes. Then the eyes begin to see the brilliance of the sun, of the light of the sun. And the same light, when it falls on an object of sense, becomes responsible for the perception of that object through the eye. But it is not merely the light of the sun that is responsible for this perception of an object outside. There is something inside us, without which perception would be impossible. The conscious element within us that peers through the eyes and receives the impressions of light emanating from outside is connected with the form of light outside. It may appear for all prosaic perception that light is inert, unconscious, and we are conscious. The perceiving individual is conscious. The light that is responsible for the perception of an object is inert. It is physical. The Upanishad at least does not believe in an ultimate physicality of things. Even the so-called physical objects are ultimately spiritual in their nature, because logic requires to posit and compel us to accept that dissimilars cannot come together and coincide. consciousness cannot come in contact with that which is dissimilar in its character. Light and consciousness cannot come in contact with each other. If consciousness were something different in nature from the light through which the perception is made possible. If light is wholly material, unspiritual or non-spiritual, bereft of the element of consciousness, consciousness cannot come in contact with it. Then there would be no such thing as perception of an object. So the Upanishad says that the idea that light outside is physical and not endowed with consciousness is erroneous. There is a Purusha in the sun as much as he is present in the eye. The consciousness that is responsible for the action of the eye in the perception of an object, the consciousness which becomes actually aware of the presence of an object, is connected with the Purusha or the consciousness in that which emanates the light or projects the light. The Purusha in the sun is the Purusha within you. Yashchaya masmin puruṣe yashchāsa vāditya sa ekaha. That which is within him, that which is within me, that which is within you, and that which is within the sun, they are one. If the two are not one, there would be no connection between light and eye. The connection between the light and the eye and the correlativity of the action of light and the action of the eye implies that there is a similarity of structure, similarity of being, similarity of essence and reality between the sun and the eye. So the sun influences the eye through his rays, and the individual that perceives objects connects himself or itself with the sun through the sense organs, particularly the eye and the pranas, which are the energies behind all sense activity. Rashmi viresha asmin pradishthita pranehi ayam amushmin. The connection between the sun and the eye is explained. And this connection is supposed to be through the rays of the sun. Here in this context, the Upanishad makes a remark. When one is about to die, he will not be able to see the sun. The rays will not impinge upon the eye and the eye will not receive the light of the sun. Yada udgrameshan bhavati shuddhameva yadan mandalam pashyati. The orb of the sun will appear not to emanate any ray at all at the time of the departure from this body. That is the absence of perception. One will not be able to see things when the light rays do not fall on the retina of the eyes. What actually happens is something like a mystery. Maybe that the sun is continuing to emanate the rays even at the time of the death of a person. He does not withdraw his rays. But the eyes cannot receive the rays. The eyes will not be able to contact the rays of the sun, and there will be no such a correlative activity between the Purusha within and the Purusha without. When a person is unable to see the ray of the sun, then they say he is about to die. This is an indication of impending death. I cannot see. That means death is coming. Now, certain interpreters of this passage say that this is a description of ordinary death, where anyone will be in this condition, whatever be the spiritual state of that person at the time of death. But others are of opinion that this is a description of that particular person alone, who is to pass through the passage of the sun in the process of gradual liberation or krama mukti. When the sun is to embrace you, when the sun is to give you passage, which interpretation seems to be the correct interpretation, as it will be corroborated and substantiated by certain passages that follow in future. the sun will give you a passage. There are about 14 stages mentioned in the Upanishads, along which the soul has to pass. One of these stages is the sun. And the sun is therefore regarded as a very important halting place of the journeying soul on the path to liberation through what is known as Krama Mukti or graduated liberation. So at the time of the departure of the soul of that person who has always been meditating in this manner, that is meditating on the identity of the Purusha in the sun with the Purusha within oneself, one who has been performing Surya Upasana in a spiritual sense, as the gateway to moksha, such a person will be given an indication of the time of the departure from the body by the sun himself, when he will be luminously present before the mind's eye of the departing soul, and the rays will be withdrawn. You have a similar passage in the Ishavasya Upanishad towards its end, where it is expressed in the form of a prayer offered by the dying soul to the Supreme Purusha in the sun. Withdraw thy rays, let me see thy true being. O Supreme Purusha in the sun, says the dying man in this prayer of the Ishavasya Upanishad. So here again, we are given to understand some such situation taking place at the time of the departure of the soul, when it is intended for liberation and not for rebirth. What happens at that time? The orb of the sun is seen to glow without any kind of emanation from there, which is supposed to be a hint from the sun that is ready to receive you. Yes, you can come. Shuddham eva etan mandalam pashyati. Nainam eti rashmaya pratyayanti. Then there will be no rays emanating. There will be only a luminosity without any kind of projection of rays to that person who is to depart for the purpose of liberation onward. This is an explanation by the way. The point made out in this section is that you have to meditate on the sun. The meditation on the sun is spiritual. It is not a gazing at the sun physically that is prescribed here, but a contemplation on the spiritual essence of the sun as the glorious energizer, the sustainer, and the producer of all living creatures on earth. An emblem of God Himself, Surya Pratyaksha Devata. Surya or the sun is regarded as the ambassador of God in this world, because none can be so glorious as He, no, so necessary as He, so resplendent as He, and so complete in every respect as He. So the sun is taken as a very fitting emblem or symbol for meditation on Brahman. This is spiritual Surya Upasana. Ya esha etasmin mandale purusha tasya bhuriti shiraha. You can expand this meditation on the sun by certain further elucidations thereof. This section that follows gives some more details of the same meditation. The sun is supposed to be the deity of the Gayatri Mantra, for instance, which is the principal mantra of the Veda. And the essence of the Gayatri is in what is known as the Vyahrati. Bhuh, Bhuah, Swah. These three symbolic letters or words are regarded as the quintessence of even the Gayatri Mantra. Now, one can contemplate on the literal meaning of these Vyahratis, not necessarily their philosophical or spiritual meaning. The literal meaning of the Vyahrati Abhur Bhuvah Swaha, the essence of the Gayatri Mantra, is also indicative of a meditation
on the Purusha in the sun. What sort of Purusha is this in the sun? You can imagine the Purusha in the sun in this manner through the Vyahrtis. Purusha tasya bhuriti shiraha ekam shiraha. The word bhuhu is representative of all physical creation. You can imagine that the whole of physical creation is comprehended in the symbol bhuhu. This is the head of the Purusha or the being in the sun. You can contemplate in this manner. Bhuhu is one letter and head also is single. Ekam shira. Ekam etu aksharam. The letter is one and the head also is one. That is similarity between the two. Bhuvaiti bahu. Bhu vaha is the astral or the atmospheric region which is above the earth. This letter bhuva consists of two, the word bhuva consists of two letters, bhuva and vaha. They can be identified with the two arms of this Purusha, two hands as it were. Just as hands are two, the letters of the word bhuva also are two. That is similarity between the two, Purusha and the letter, the word. Bhuva iti bahu, gom bahu, vene iti akshane. Now you have got the third letter. Word of the
Swara. Swariti pratishtha dve pratishthe.
You can imagine Swaha as the legs of the Purusha on which his whole body is supported. Two are the legs. Swa are the letters of the word Swaha, Suvaha. That is the similarity between the letters of the word and the legs of the Purusha. So the head, the hands and the feet may be imagined in meditation as representing or as represented by the meaning of the three words in the Vyahrti of the Gayatri Mantra, Bhuhu, Bhuvaha and Swaha, Dve Ede Akshare, Tasya Upanishad Ahariti. Upanishad means the secret meaning. What is the secret meaning of this mantra, Vyahrti? Its secret is also the secret of the Gayatri mantra. There is one word in the Gayatri mantra which is supposed to be indicative of destruction of all sins. Bhargaha is the word. There is a word called Bhargaha in Gayatri which means the destroyer of all sins. And the character, the capacity, the function of the sun is to destroy all sins. And the day that is the effect of the rise of the sun is also indicated by a word which is suggestive of destruction of sin. Ahaha. In Sanskrit, ahar means the daylight. And the daylight emanates from the sun himself. And in Sanskrit, ahar is a word that is derived from the root hr, which is to suggest the destruction of sins. So the sun is the destroyer of sins, even as the Vyahrtis, which are the essence of the Gayatri mantra, are capable of the same effect. So how do you contemplate sun? As a supreme Purusha, the divine being, who is the deity of the mantra, of the Veda, of the Gayatri, of the three Vyahrtis, and as the supreme destroyer of sins. She who contemplates on the supreme being in the Purusha in the sun as the destroyer of sins, destroys all sins. No sin can touch him. Hanti papmanam jahati cha ya evam veda. One who knows this becomes pure like the sun and free from sin in every respect.
Various types of meditation through symbols and conceptual forms have been described partly, and some more of a different category are being mentioned further on in this chapter of the Upanishad. The present theme happens to be an attempt on the part of the meditator to unify the objective side with the subjective side. A symbol that is used in this way of meditation is the correspondence or the coordination between the sun and the eye, or the Purusha in the sun with the Purusha within, God above and soul inside. These two are en rapport, they are coordinated, and they represent the universal or the cosmic side and the individual side respectively. One of the points specially mentioned in this particular method of meditation is that while the sense of selfhood or I-ness is the main characteristic of the conscious subject, that characteristic seems to be absent in the object. We cannot feel a sense of selfhood in the sun, or for the matter of that, anything outside us. The sense of I is identified only with the conscious subject, the me, or what is regarded as the perceiving individual. It does not occur to any individual at any time that this sense of I-ness or the sense of selfhood can be present in others also, though it may be accepted only as a logical conclusion and a tenable position in philosophy. It is not directly cognized in daily activity. The selfhood in others is never recognized. It is not recognized even in God Himself. He is held as an object of contemplation, a kind of form cosmically conceived, fit to be meditated upon by a conscious subject, so that the I or the self refuses to be externalized. And so, taking this stand, the Upanishad tells us that the conscious subject or the Purusha within is characterized by the feeling of aham or I. Whereas the attributes which we superimpose on the Purusha in the sun are anything and everything except the sense of selfhood. So, the term used here is Ahariti Tasya Upanishad. The secret name that we give to the sun, the Purusha in the sun, is Aha, the destroyer of sins, the magnificent Purusha, the radiant being, and so on and so forth. But never do we say it is a self, because the self can only be one. We cannot have two selves. The difficulty of recognizing the selfhood in others is that we cannot accept the presence of two selves. It is repugnant to the sense of I that there can be another I. So, instinctively we refuse to recognize the presence of I or self in other people and other things, notwithstanding the fact that
we can philosophically accept it, that there is intelligence in others, that there is selfhood in others, and there is a status each one maintains for one's own self, not in any way inferior to the one that is attributed to one's own self. This is a philosophical, rational conclusion. But instinct speaks a different language. The instinct says, the I is the conscious being, that which perceives, that which thinks and understands. But that which is understood, that which is thought of, that which is cognized or perceived, that which is ahead of me, in front of me, as an object, it has a different name altogether. That which I see with my eyes is not a subject, it is an object. And how can I attribute I to it? The meditation tries to overcome this difficulty by establishing an inward coordination between the external Purusha, the Purusha in the sun, and the Purusha within, which means to say that the universality of the Purusha in the sun should be capable of being identified with the selfhood of the Purusha within. This is the secret of meditation. The selfhood that we attribute to our own self should be identified with all the realities that we see in external things. Now this point is elucidated further on in a very important meditation that is hinted at in the following mantra. Hari Om Tat Sat.